Hello and welcome back to the Game Pit. This is episode 69. I'm Sean and this is the last episode before the Essen madness descends.
Whoop, 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 whoop. Yeah, we're going to be picking over the bones again of seven games today. Our main review is Manches of Ban, the second edition, as previously promised. And hot on the heels of this episode, we're going to start our Spiel 2016 Treasure Hunt episodes, which we're going to be previewing 12 games an episode. And hopefully we're going to get a few of those out to you to enjoy, anticipate, see what you might be wanting to buy at the fair or afterwards when they start coming through.
Very good, and we are also going to talk in the first half of the show, as usual, about three games that have piqued our interest or that we've been playing of late. Ronan, what are your three games?
Mine are Hit Zeroed, shocking name, Let the Meat Cake, and Steve-On. Fetch the table, Sean.
And my three, Ronan, are The Networks, Ticket to Ride the United Kingdom Map, and Sapiens.
Okay, hope you enjoy the reviews. You can catch all our episodes on iTunes and Stitcher and Podbean, where we're hosted, and fantastic gaming content. Head to dicetower.com. We're part of the Dice Tower Network, and there are fantastic podcasts you can listen to over there.
Ronan, we are about to kick off with our three games each. What's your first one?
We're going to Hit Zeroed, Sean.
Oh, we're hitting it bad, because it's a bad name.
No, I'm not happy. Anyway, it's for 2 to 4 players. It's about a 45-minute playing time. The publisher is Space Cowboys. The designer is Martin Wallace. You couldn't get a bigger name than that. This year and previously, Via Nebula, Ships, The Arrivals coming out at Essen. Previous games, Brass Steam, London, Automobile, Runebound. The list goes on and on. The story of this game is, it's a recreation of the journey of a young boy called Martin, who travelled from Chicago to LA during a zombie apocalypse, and he's made a game, and you've now got hold of the game, and you're going to recreate that journey. And the fantastic part about that is that the game looks like it's made out of all reused bits, cards from other games that have been taped over, like Dixit and Ticket to Ride, and from an old diner, and all the resources are bottle caps. So it's got this whole idea that you're reliving in this mixed up way that he's put it together, his journey from Chicago to LA. The way you're going to do that is you're going to be auctioning resources in order to choose your route across the country and try and survive to the very end, and the most victory points at the end is going to win. So you start with some resources. You have three of them. The first one is ammunition. That's going to allow you to fire guns, which are going to let you shoot at zombies before they can get close enough to bite you. There's also gas for whatever vehicle you may be in, and that's going to allow you to escape the zombies before they get close enough to eat you. And the last one is adrenaline, and that's going to basically help you in combat. We'll get to that when I explain how combat works. So it's quite simple. The first player begins off and there's an auction track, and they bid a number of resources they're willing to spend to get first choice off a route via card. So what you do is you deal out 2 cards per route, 4 of them, so there's going to be 8 cards on the table. If you've got fewer players, the players have dropped out and been killed, there's ways of mitigating against that. But basically, you bid, and there's a track 1 to 10, and you put your dobber on there, whatever number it may be. Next player gets to bid or pass. You can never bid the same as the previous player or anyone else, but you can bid higher or lower. So if the first player's gone to 3, I can go to 2, 1, 4, pass, whatever it may be. When everyone has passed in succession, you then change around the turn order, and whoever has bid the most is going to get first choice of routes. Now, you're just bidding with those resources. 3 ammo equals 3 gas equals 3 adrenaline. Whatever you want to do, it's your choice what you want to spend according to where you think you want to go, how you think you're going to use those resources. Now, when you choose a route, you look at the 2 cards, and they're going to have some information on there. The first thing is they're going to give you some resources, hopefully, and they'll just have icons to say, take 2 bullets, take 1 gas, whatever it might be. Then in the middle, there may be some special rules. You may have to pick up a token, especially in the first play. You may not necessarily know what that token does. It might be a sniper rifle, might be a biohazard, it might be getting an extra survivor, it could be a steering wheel. There's various different ones that come with the game, and they are going to have effects further on, depending upon what routes you go in each round. Then lastly on there, there's going to be some zombies you have to fight. There's just going to be a number of zombies. There may be a horde of zombies, and all that means is you have to roll slightly tougher dice when you're fighting against a horde. So the first thing you get to do is you may spend that ammo. For each ammo, you get to roll two dice. Three of the six faces, you can have a hit, and you'll be able to take some of the zombies away. Then you can get a choice to run away. You'd spend two gas tokens and say, that's it, I don't want to fight them, depending upon how that shooting's gone. If you haven't killed them on shooting and you haven't gone away with your gas, then you get to fight them hand to hand. You roll one dice for each survivor that you have left. You start with five. As they die, you're going to roll fewer dice. And when you roll them again, you've got that one in three opportunity really to hit. You've also got a one in six opportunity of being bitten. Now, you can kill them with a hit. There's also an opportunity hit, which means you can spend an adrenaline to get a hit. There's a boost kill, which is you get a kill and you can spend adrenaline to get a second kill. There's also every time the zombie goes to bite you, you can spend the adrenaline and avoid that bite. So that's why you might want to keep hold of the adrenaline, to kill more zombies and, very importantly, not to get bitten when they have the chance to do that. If you kill all the zombies, if you go through the whole card, you get to keep the card, and there may well be some points on there, and that is the main points generating aspect of the game. As I said, some of those tokens you take later on may penalise or benefit you. If you've got a biohazard, you go to another area, you may lose some life. People you pick up might help you or hinder you. If you've got the steering wheel, you may be able to pick up a school bus and suddenly you're more powerful. If anyone survives to the end and you go through three levels of difficulty through this, and they're all just represented by these sets of two cards of these routes, if you make it all the way to the end and get to LA, you count up the points on your cards, and then you get 3 points as a bonus scoring for having the most of everything in the game. So the most adrenaline, the most gas, the most ammo, and in fact the most survivors left. Sean, any thoughts on Hit Z Road?
Well, apart from the bad name, I kind of let this one slide past me, Ronan. I didn't even know if it was a zombie game because I hadn't actually seen the box cover. It comes quite obvious because the Z is in red, but yeah, it kind of passed by me. Now, you bought this and you started explaining to me about the production of it, and that's what sort of captured my interest. The way you take off the cover and it reveals an old board game on the back of the box, and the bottle caps are used for tokens, and as you said, the different cards from different games being sort of co-opted into this game. It sounds like a fabulous production.
It's fantastic. You can't help, I think, but love the game when you start off with it. Like you said, you buy the game and under the cellophane there is the usual blurb for Hit Z Road. When you take the cellophane off, that turns out to be a sheet of paper that drops off. And the idea is this kid has taken the game Hit The Road and he's sort of morphed it into Hit Z Road. And the rules for Hit The Road are on the back. And it's just a lovely touch. The Space Cowboys are so good at the physical production of games. And that gets you off on the right foot. And what it really helps with, I think, is that this is quite a harsh game. It's quite hard. You are outbidding each other. You can really stitch each other up and put each other down difficult routes. And that way they've made it, I think, takes a bit of the edge off and makes it a little bit more fun than it might otherwise be.
So there seems to be quite a lot of elements to this game. There is the dice rolling, you've got the bidding, you've got the resource collection and management. So what I guess I'm asking you, Ronan, is how well do they all blend together? Does any of them sort of stand out like a sore thumb, or is it a sort of cohesive unit?
Oh yeah, it's totally cohesive. It's very quick as well. It's very smooth. I taught it to a 10-year-old and she was off and flying in the first round. It absolutely all goes together because you're in charge of what you're playing. You prioritize. You can have an idea which route people are going to go down and how much you're going to get stitched up. It's quite clear in all the iconography. How it ties thematically and to spending the most resources to choose the best route, not so sure. But it does mean that every single resource matters. It does feel like it's kind of an achievement to survive. It means that you really do feel like you're in peril with a very light rule set. And I think that's kind of the magic I found in the game.
Before you sum up and let us know exactly how you feel about the game, this one contains within its boundaries, if you like, one of my most hated things in games. You can be eliminated from the game. Now, can you be ruled out early? And I want you to sell me on this, Roland.
If you play badly, really badly, I guess you could get ruled out early. But early is 20 minutes in and there's only 20 minutes left. So at least it's a short game. A player elimination, obviously, lots of people don't like it. It's hard to defend it in and of itself. But what it does is it makes the choices matter, because you can see and go, I could be out of this game if I get stuck going down that awful route, because the resources are so valuable in themselves. They're worth that gunshot. The adrenaline is worth avoiding a bite. You'd never spend them. You just go, oh, I'll go down any route. It doesn't matter. They have to be tough to make it worthwhile spending the resources, and they are tough. So you do want to get ahead. And there's a good push of luck on the auction as well, because you might go, I'm not bidding yet. We'll see how this goes. Because if it jumps up to 1, 2, 3, 4, especially by the time you get to the second or third round, or second or third sort of level of difficulty rather than round, you're looking at it going, oh, I can't spend 5. There's no way I can spend 5. But look where I am. I'm going to take the most awful route that ever existed. And you can get really stuck in a dilemma and maybe take that risk. And because it all comes down to dice rolls, you are at least taking a risk and going, well, oh, I could survive. And I think it's got that fun factor that adds into it. I can't sell player elimination. I can only say that it fits in with the theme of the game. And when someone has a ridiculous dice roll and rolls 3 zombie bites and they run out of adrenaline and suddenly they're out when maybe they had the most survivors going into that round, it is pretty funny.
Not in this household.
Ah, get out of here. Look, it's got fantastically tense dice rolls. It's really funny. It's got a quick play time. It's all presented beautifully. It works thematically. I have really fallen for Hitsy Road. I think it's a really good game. And I'm pretty certain you'd love it if you played it, Sean.
I think I probably would, even with the player elimination. So it sounds like it's my kind of thing for sure. Okay, I'm going to move on to The Networks. This is a game from Gil Hover, published by Formal Ferret Games, playing 1 to 5 players. So what is The Networks? Well, players are going to be setting up new television networks, and the whole game really covers around getting the best combination of shows, stars and adverts for your prime time slots. So on each round, players can buy and or add TV shows, stars and adverts from the available set. And what do these do? Well, shows have 4 seasons worth of viewers. Stars will add to those viewer figures, and the adverts will put money back into the coffers so that you can buy more stars and shows, etc. Each game is going to last for 5 seasons, and the only other thing available are network cards, and these are going to give you an immediate ongoing boon or give you points at the end of the game. So once players have done all they want to do or can do in a round, then they will score the shows by measuring each season's viewing figures, and then you add them to your general score. After each season, the viewer number for each show will change. It will drop down to the next level. And after 5 rounds, basically the players with the most viewers in total will win the game. It sounds very simple, Ronan. Did it play out like that?
Yes and no. So I find that at the beginning of each round, you're quite clear in what you need, because you're trying to build these synergies together and you're going to have decided yourself where your priority is. So you say, right, that's the card I really need, or those are the 2 cards I'm really after. The decision of getting there takes a bit of maths and a bit of working out and a bit of looking at what everyone else wants and going, oh, and usually it's quite clear what the very best cards are. So at the beginning, it's kind of a lot of thought, and then a tight draft. And then it kind of loosens off towards the end of the round. And then I felt, Sean, you were picking up a load of stuff that was, yeah, kind of equally as good to you as some other stuff was. And it kind of lost a bit of the tension in the drafting, because really the tight working out all becomes at that beginning.
It's kind of like a roller coaster almost. It's
you do you like roller coasters?
You're an idiot. You have rounds in where you do need lots of things, and you have rounds where you've kind of got your engine for the next 1 or 2 rounds and you're literally doing nothing. You might pick up an advert for use later, or a star if there's a particularly good one, and you're kind of just sitting tight.
That's also somewhat driven by the card draw as well, because synergies are quite tough to put together.
They are. You sometimes get an advert that's a beer advert or something, and they will give you more money if you attach it to a sports show, and sometimes those sports shows just don't come out, so you end up not getting the full whack of its resources. So yeah, I don't know that the synergies is what this is all about. I think it's more of a game of timing and making sure that your TV shows don't run out of steam, and picking and choosing the right times to buy things rather than the actual things themselves.
There's a lot of reward for getting them together, or, you know, certain stars only want to be in certain things, and only certain situations in which you can get them into play. And some of it is timing. You have to have two adverts held back, or there has to be another star in your green room, wherever it may be. But some of them are also, well, this dude is only good in a comedy show. Now I've got to find a comedy show that comes out at the right time with the right strength in the right time slot to meet what else I've done in this game. Like in the first round, it's okay, but things are generally looser and you're scoring for your points anyway. But when you've got that slot at 8 o'clock, is that strong for two seasons? I'm not going to touch that now for a while. I need a 9 o'clock show. You're then trying to fit the pieces together, and sometimes it falls and sometimes it doesn't fall.
The later that you pick up those very specific cards, it's more of a gamble. So in the first round, if you pick up a star that's only wants to do action films or documentaries or something, you've got a good chance of picking up that along the way at some time, because you've got five rounds to do it in. I think if you pick it on the last round, you're kind of on hiding to nothing, because you are really reliant on one draw of cards. Again, I think the timing comes into it. One thing we haven't really talked about, Ronan, is there's a lot of humour in this game. The cards are genuinely funny. The psychic cat cards, and they brought a bit of a chuckle in your particular household.
You kind of worry a bit, don't you, when you see a game and you think, oh, it's got funny names of TV shows that are sort of satirical or whatever, and you think, oh, yeah, is it really going to be funny? It really genuinely is funny. I had a chuckle at loads of them, and like the stereotypical actors. Not only are they funny, but he's also found a way to make them work thematically, so that when you look at the numbers down the side, you go, actually, that does make sense. The guy who always dies, you can flip him over. And it does work, what they've done. It does tie together. And that side of it I really like. The other sort of individual thing about networks is the art style, Sean, which I found worked much less successfully. I'm not a fan of the art style, so big tick for the humour. I didn't really like looking at it on the table.
It's very functional. I think it's very easy to pick out, to make sense.
But that's iconography is very good.
Yeah, it is. But I think the art style flows in to that iconography. It's a very simplistic. You're right, it doesn't look amazing on the table. It's kind of that got a stylish feel to it without actually looking very pretty.
Oh, I don't know, I think it looks messy.
You think?
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, I didn't get that. I thought it was.
It looks a bit like Terrence and Philip.
A little bit.
That's just what I think, anyway. All right. In terms of gameplay, I think the big balance here and where you can get yourself in trouble is you need income, and obviously you need to carry on scoring through every round. One bad round will put you out of the running, because it does tend to be quite a tight race. What do you think about that whole seesaw of income and scoring in the networks?
Yeah, I think it is only over five rounds. So, like, you take a fifth of your game out in this and you're really playing catch-up, and you have to have a massive round. And everybody else tends to move at a similar speed. So it is very hard to catch up if you do have that bad round. You have to be on your game all the time. You have to be aware of what other people are doing all the time. So if somebody is after that advert that matches up, or that star that matches up to a certain show, you can maybe deny them if you are having one of those rounds where you're not doing much for yourself per se. You can start looking at how you're going to mess with other people. So you still got something to do even in those quiet rounds.
Cool. Okay. Those quiet rounds for me are sometimes a case of just taking a card, hoping that next time it will match up with something, because I don't know what's coming next. Game length. Now, I want to tell you a story. I was near a game of it being played at London on Board. It was five players, admittedly. It took them 3.5 hours. Comment, please, Sean.
That's just absolutely crazy. The first time I played this with my wife, and that's including learning it from the rule book, which is quite an easy task to do. It's a very good rule book, I'll say that about it. The game took around about an hour, maybe an hour and 10 minutes. And the three-player game we played at your house, including the explanation that I gave, took about an hour and a half tops. I don't even think it went that far, Ronan. So a three-hour game of this seems...
And a half. Incredible. Don't miss off the half.
A three-and-a-half-hour game of this seems absolutely incredible. Now, I've played with some slow players in my time, but that just seems way beyond the pale.
But they all said they loved it. And I was like, did we miss something? I was talking to them, like, how was it? And the way they described it was exactly the same process we went through. They had fun. You just go, okay, cool. Do you want to play it again? They all said yes. I was like, okay, fine.
No, this game shouldn't ever take anything like that. I think even with a 4 or 5 player game, once you know it, an hour and a half tops.
Yeah, I think so too. So the networks, there's a bit of maths involved here. There's a bit of thinking ahead. There's some quite tight drafting at the beginning of each round. You have to be aware of the transient strength of all your shows. They're going to ebb and flow. It's actually quite hard work. There's a lot of thinking going on. As Sean said, you do have to be aware of what other people are doing, what's in their green room, what's best for them. A little bit of denial drafting. In the end, it's actually quite a light game, though. So you have to be willing to work quite hard for your hour and a half. It's thematic. It's quite funny. Everything makes sense and works. It's got a theme that everyone's familiar with, so everyone clicks into it straight away and knows what they're doing. A star and an advert goes on a TV show. Cool, boom, got that. You're only managing 3 TV shows at a time, so it's not overwhelming. I think The Networks is a good, solid game, and I would happily play it again.
Well, no, we like to come up with something different, Ronan, for these, but I concur with everything you've said there. I've just got down on my notes. It's for very simple gameplay. It manages to crowbar a lot of thought into that simple framework. And I quite like the design of it. It's very stylized. I do love the humour of it. We had genuine laughs at the cards. The theme ties in really well with everything. As Rona said, you don't really have to explain the theme to people. People just will get it. So, yeah, a really interesting game. Plays very well at the different player counts. And it's a game that me and my wife particularly enjoy playing. So, yeah, it's a definite hit for me.
Lovely. Fantastic. Moving on to our third game of the episode. This is Let Them Eat Cake. From Osprey Games, 3 to 6 players, a 60-minute playtime. The designer is Pierre Sylvester. He's famous for the two-player game Wir sind das Volk, Konig von Siam that I spoke about earlier this year, Discover India. The game itself, Let Them Eat Cake, is themed around you are part of the revolutionary committee in France, obviously just post-revolution. And there are shifting positions within the committee which you're going to be nominating people for, taking control yourself. And you're trying to amass 40 cake. That's your currency. That's what you're after before the committee collapses. And if someone gets 40 cake, that triggers the end of the game. Most cake is going to win. Everybody starts with 3 pawns. And those pawns basically designate how powerful your vote is. And they can get killed in the game. You've got 3 medals of honor to show how well you've worked for the revolution previous to the beginning of the game. And you have 3 cake cards, which are 1 strength each. And they go in your cake pile. And that starts you off on the way to 40. You get cards which correspond to the player colours of all the other players. So for 3 or 4 players, you get 2 cards each for each other player. 5 or 6 players, you get 1 card off each of the other players. You're going to go through a round voting on a number of positions within the committee. And for each vote, everyone plays 1 card face down and you flip them all over. The strength of the card is equal to the number of pawns you have left. As I said, whoever has got the highest level of vote for them is going to fulfill that role, and obviously I'll explain what all the roles are. You don't pick up the cards that you've used to vote until all the cards have been played. So if you can have some kind of memory, you can have some idea of who's voted for who already, who's likely to get voted in as we go on until people refill their hands. Before each vote, you are actively encouraged to negotiate with each other, to discuss who you're going to vote for, to ally up and say, if you vote for me, I'll vote for you next time, to lie to each other. You can bribe each other with cake and medals of honour and all sorts of things, acting in true despicable style in order to get one up and collect the most cake. So the positions you're going to be voting for quickly are the head of committee. The head of committee is going to break all ties from now on. So the previous head of committee is going to break a tie going in. That may have occurred to you when I was talking about voting before. They also gain one Medal of Honor, and then they can take a Medal of Honor from another person. Then we go to the enemy of revolution. Why am I talking about these Medals of Honor? Whoever has the fewest Medals of Honor is called the enemy of the revolution. They haven't done enough to make it successful. And one of their pawns is going to go up to get killed. However, if there's a tie for fewest medals, there's going to be a vote on that, but only off the people who are tied for fewest medals. We then have to nominate a guillotine operator, and they decide whether the person, the enemy of revolution, their pawn, is going to get killed or not. If they fulfill their duty and they kill that pawn, they get three medals of honor and they get to take a general from the general stack. What are generals for? I haven't mentioned them before. I'm going to get to them when I'm at the end of discussing all these bits, because they just mess around a little bit with the rules. If you grant mercy as the guillotine operator, you're viewed with suspicion and you lose a Medal of Honor. So you are more likely to become the enemy of revolution next time round. Obviously, strong position for negotiating there between the enemy of revolution and the guillotine operator. The next person to get voted for is the secretary. They will draw one card per player from what's called the pantry stack, and on those cards are going to be a level of cake up to somewhere in the teens, or there's going to be a general on there, and then they divvy out one card to each player face up in front of them so everyone can see what's going on, but they don't take those cards yet because that cake needs to be looked at. We need to be voting for a food inspector. The food inspector decides whether cake cards that have been divvied out so far are unsafe or not. All generals that are handed out for the pantry deck, they get kept, don't worry about them. However, if the food inspector decides the cake is unsafe, all the cake that's been handed out gets discarded. But the food inspector has to lose one medal because it seems a bit suspect. Maybe they poisoned that cake. I don't know. If they say the cake is safe, everyone takes the cake. Or they have the option of throwing the card away, saying, let them eat cake, and you can steal a Medal of Honor from another player if you choose to do so with your cake. Now, I was talking about generals. What can they do in the game quickly? If you can spend one general to claim vote rigging and do a new vote on the vote just had, you can spend two generals to seize cake. So when the secretary has handed out the cake, you can spend two generals and take the cake from someone else that's face up in front of them. Or if you have three generals, you can spend them to stage a coup and just simply decide how a vote is going to go and who wins without anyone casting any votes. So once the food inspector has looked at the cake, if anyone's got 40 cake or more, that's game over. Most cake wins. If they haven't, we go back again, vote again for head of committee, and carry on through until we have a winner. Sean, do you wish to let them eat cake?
Boy, I think the designer of this sounds like they've eaten a lot of cake. They're on a massive sugar high. There is a lot going on here, Ronan.
No!
How much voting can a voting game have when you have to vote?
Many, many votings of all the voterage.
Does it ever get boring just voting all the time?
No, because the voting takes a second. Everyone card face down, flip it over, right, who got voted in? The arguing, that's where all of the life is in the game. It's really more an arguing game than a voting game.
But is there any depth in a negotiation? Isn't it not just you vote for me and I'll vote for you next time?
Well, you can't do that. Usually there's enough players. If you play with three, maybe you could. I wouldn't play it with three. Four is quite a low count. Go for five or six in this. It's quite tough to arrange that. And if you set up that two-way agreement between you, how is everyone else at the table going to treat you? As soon as your pawn's up for in, right, you're dead. You can make alliances short term. If you start trying to build up too much of this sort of, oh, look after you, look after me, people are just going to split you up. They're just going to throw it, right? Okay, fine. You get the rubbish cards. We're going to kill you. It's so transient. And the way that card system works, it's very difficult to build up those sort of blocks in it.
I looked at this and I was quite excited about it. A big fan of Osprey games and the theatre of actually having the person's meeple in the guillotine, but it just looked messy. I was trying to understand what was going on each round, and maybe if I actually play this game, because we're going through a bit of a phase now, Ronan, where we're kind of playing a lot of games separately from each other. Mm-hmm. So these sections tend to be more of a question than answer, but maybe it's a game that I have to play to just get what's going on and the dynamics of the group coming into it as well. But it just looked like it was going to be really hard to follow. The rules just read like and then you do this, and then you do this, and then if that happens, this happens.
But what happens is, I agree with you, And when I was teaching it, I was looking at it going, oh, don't know how this all ties together. I'm not sure why would you do this or why would you do that. One round, it becomes very clear what each role does, becomes very clear what the importance of medals are. It becomes very clear what you're doing, and you're in, and you're flowing, and you're going. It takes 5 minutes to play around, and everyone knows exactly what's going on because each role flows in. It's so quick. Head of committee, get a medal, you break tie. Enemy of revolution, straight up, your pawn's up there. Guillotine operator, do we kill them or not? Deal out some cake. Are we getting that cake or not? That's a round. I know, I understand what you're saying. I think there's a few layout issues in the rules. There's a couple of rules dropped in here and there at the end of paragraphs when they would have been clearer elsewhere. I don't think it's the best rule book, but it's a very smooth playing game. It's very quick. It's very too easy to understand. There's so many votes that things just change all the time. Alliances are swapping all the time. It's much smoother than that rule book makes it seem.
Okay, Ronan, you seem to be enjoying it, so I think I'll give it a go, but I'm coming in with one eyebrow raised, just understand.
But I think lots of people, I think it's quite a hard sell, actually, when you say to people, here's this idea, and any voting game, negotiation game, people are a bit like, oh, I don't know. Some of the things they've done, I think, really works here. The presentation is fantastic and takes the edge off the nastiness. And the fact that you're fighting over cake, everyone just has a laugh and be like, oh, look how much cake I've got, how much cake you've got. That one word kind of tones it down a bit. It's got the brilliance that you feel like you want to be in a role until you get elected into that role. And then you go, oh, I don't want to be in here. Because you've got a decision to make every single time, albeit a small one. Head of committee, who do I take a medal from? By taking the medal from someone, I may well be deciding who's the enemy of revolution who's going to lose a pawn. And by doing that, I might be setting myself up. But then the guillotine operator, I get three medals. And a general if I kill that person up there. But now they're going to hate me because I've killed them. So what can I do to mitigate against that? And then the secretary, you're like, oh, yeah, I'd love to be able to divvy up the cards. And then you realise, hold on, I don't know who's going to be food inspector. Oh, so... oh, I've got to think who's likely to win, who can I give a good card to? Oh, I can't give myself the best card because it'll definitely give. And all of this comes in as you play it, but they're all small decisions, but they're all funny. Everyone's giving you advice, everyone's abusing you. No one's happy with what you've decided. Oh, you've given them the best card. What did you give them the best card for? Everyone vote for me, food inspector, whatever it might be. I think it really works. It's really funny. It's quick. You do need to have an engaged group. They do need to be willing to roll with the blows, but Let Them Eat Cake is definitely one to keep an eye on.
Okay. We're going to go on to one that should be very familiar to everybody and a very easy sell to the fans of the series. I'm talking Ticket to Ride UK map. Now, this comes with the Pennsylvania map as well. It's volume 5 of the map collection. But I'm going to talk about just the UK side, because that's the side I've played. So I'm not really going to explain how Ticket to Ride works, because it's a very famous game. We've covered it in the show, and I think almost everybody that will be listening to this will understand exactly how Ticket to Ride plays out. But what does Ticket to Ride UK bring to it? Well, it brings technology, and it brings a license to build in certain areas. So players are going to need to spend locomotive cards. Now, these are way more important in the United Kingdom game. And there's more of them in the deck as a result. And you're going to spend these locomotive cards to buy technology. That allows you to do certain things. You have to have the technology to build 3 space routes. So you start off being able just to build in 1 and 2 space routes. You have to get another technology to build 4, 5, 6 routes. Ferry routes are a thing here. If you're going across the sea at all, you have to have that technology. I think it's the propeller technology. You can have technology that gives you additional points per route. And there's also cards that allow you to build in Wales, Scotland and Ireland. And until you have them, you cannot do so. Now, you can exchange 4 of any other card in place of a locomotive, but I think you kind of get the gist that locomotives are very important. There's not much more to this. It's still the same route-building game that Ticket to Ride is, Ronan.
Okay. Firstly, and very importantly, it's not the UK map, is it?
You do have Ireland in there. You have France in there. You even have New York in there.
Okay. It's not the UK map. Let's get that very clear, shall we? Not happy with this whatsoever. You need to build up the technology in order to be able to sort of get into the proper game ticket to ride Sean and build longer routes. Is there any frustration in that early game? And by the way, guys, I haven't played with the new map as per our new pattern. Is there any frustration early on when you can't do everything that you'd be used to doing and planning long term in normal ticket to ride?
I think initially it's quite exciting just to have to look to buy things and bring them into your tableau, and it's something new to the sort of ticket to ride feeling. But that, it's a byproduct of the thing that is very frustrating, Ronan, and that is locomotives. It's a completely random draw, as it always is in Ticket to Ride. If you don't get the locomotives into your hand, and other players do, they will win this game. It's as simple as that. There's nothing you can do about it. I've played three times. One time I was the lucky player and I got loads of locomotives and I didn't have to worry about spending four cards, given that you're only picking up two per go to exchange for those locomotives. And on two times I was the player who didn't get any locomotives and I was just completely ruled out of the game. Everything cost locomotives. So therefore, if you've got no way of definitely getting that currency into your hand, nothing you can do, Ronan.
Oh, we hadn't actually spoken about whether you enjoyed this map before. You've thrown me for a loop there. I was expecting positivity all over.
I was very positive going into this, even reading the rules, very positive. You know what I was like at the UK Games Expo when I thought this had run out everywhere because I'd sort of set my heart on getting it.
Sobbing.
And then I found it in one of the stalls and I was so happy. And I finally got around to playing it, Ronan, and
I had a few more questions, but I feel like they're useless now. We've kind of got to the heart of the matter, haven't we? Did you find it balanced out at any point and you actually have had a good game of it, or was it just every single game was down to that luck of the draw?
I think at the beginning, when you are kind of your level and you think that everything's sort of progressing, and maybe it's just bad luck, but everything's progressing at the same sort of speed. At about halfway through the game, you realise, hang on, I'm constantly having to change up four of my cards, and which is completely depleting all my resources to build routes to get locomotives. And at one point in our first game, my wife just said to me, listen, I'm so sorry. My last four blind draws, I've picked up seven locomotives. I'm like, yeah, that is ridiculous luck. But yeah, at that point, she just felt that she had to apologise, because I'm there going, oh my word, how am I going to, if I buy that, I can't expand into Scotland this turn or even next turn because I've got to build up my cards again. I just can't get the locomotives. And she's just sitting there going, I'm so sorry. she's in Wales, Scotland, Ireland, and she was building up to another issue I've got. Well,
hold on. It sounded like she'd built out of the UK. Anyway, carry on. Another issue, Sean.
Another issue is there's a route that you take from Southampton to New York, and it's worth a whole heap of points. I think it's about 40 points, and in a game where you're scoring about 100, maybe slightly more, 40 points plus some bonus cards if you've managed to get them because you keep getting locomotive cards, that's a game winner. It's worth too many points. I find the balance of this game was just off for me, Ronan. Yeah.
Wow. So good. Ouch. Okay. I was going to say that I'm always interested in a bit of Ticket to Ride. I always look at these maps. My family have drifted away from it a little bit. It just hasn't got to the table. I'm sure, you know, we're going to go through another spurt in however long's time of playing it a few times, and I'll look to pick up one of these maps. Sounds like the not just UK map is not the one for us.
It's one of those things. I think Ticket to Ride has always had that sort of luck-based element to it. Do you pick up the right cards? And do you get the tickets that match what you're doing? But there was always a kind of gamble that you were sort of prepared to take. If you just can't get the cards that you need into your hand by fair means or foul, it just kind of ruined the experience for me. I also think the design, because they had to sort of clearly differentiate the areas, I think the colour choices they use, which is probably completely functional, they have to keep the colour choices away from everything else that's going on the map, but you just the colour choices even in this game just felt a bit gaudy and garish to me, and yeah, just really, really disappointed. So I think maybe flip over, play Pennsylvania and see whether I'm going to keep this expansion.
Wow. I think we need to move on. You're really getting angry. Right. For my last game of Section 1 this time round, I'm going to talk about Devon. This came out from Don and Company. It's a two-player game, 30 minutes long. It's from Chris Burm. Now, Chris Burm did something called the GIPF Project, including games such as GIF, Inch, Punked Czar, and Devon. They're being reprinted currently, which is possibly what brought this back into my mind, so keep an eye out for them. For this particular one, Devon, you have a board with 49 spaces, which is a kind of an offset grid, 5x10, with each space that's in the middle board having six other spaces adjacent to it. It's kind of a hexagonal pattern without the actual hexes. In the game, you've got three red Devon pieces, which are going to get placed first of all on the board by the players. Then each player, and there's white and there's black, has 23 playing pieces. These are all little discs, and they are going to place them one at a time across the board until you've seeded all 49 spaces to begin the game. To begin playing, and indeed on each of your turns, you can move a stack you control, and controlling a stack simply means you have got the disc on top of it. So to start off, you've got 49 one height stacks, and you move one of your pieces. It moves as far as it is tall. So in this case, you're just going to move one piece, one space, and it's going to land off any of the spaces around it. The other rule for moving is that the stack must land on a piece. You cannot move onto an empty space. So from that very first move onwards, you're starting to limit the number of moves available. Also, in order to remain on the board, each stack must remain in contact with at least one Devon piece, meaning that it's got to be connected via non-empty spaces to a Devon piece. Now, Devon pieces can become part of stacks and they can be moved around, but at any time there's a piece isolated or a group piece isolated, they're gone off the board. Okay. The game finishes when there are no more moves made. As you can imagine, you end up with lots of taller stacks around the place. You then take all the stacks that have got your colour piece on top of them, you build them into a big tower, you compare the heights of the two towers, and whoever has the highest tower wins. And that is the rules for Devon.
Why do you want me to look at drafts?
Oh, Sean. You heathen. Philistine heathen. How dare you? Yeah, it is a two-player abstract. It's got black and white pieces. They are discs. This will all go with you. If I was just to have seen this game or heard of it and didn't know the background to it, I'd have dismissed it, I reckon. But the GIF project has got a reputation for being the best in two-player abstracts. And I got it as part of a math trade. It was just one of those random things where you click a load of games and go, yeah, I'll take any of them. And I happened to get Devon. And I had it for quite a while before I cracked it out. Yeah. Have you got any more comments before I go on?
I'm on the more serious note, Ronan. And I heard that the setup is very tedious because you're all having to place your individual colours, and it's one and one and one and one, and it takes quite a lot of time and almost as much time as the game itself.
Well, I've played the game half a dozen times. I have no idea what the strategy is in the setup. We have pretty much agreed for now to just slap them down at the same time as each other, just not putting too much thought into it because we can't see the pattern behind it. Even after six plays, we can see patterns emerging in play. Setup itself is a bit of a mystery. So actually, I kind of put the thing out on Twitter. Mark Johnson, who was on with us, or me, a couple of episodes ago, he went, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the setup is either. And he's played it a few times, so do you know what? Don't spend 10 minutes setting up. Just slap them down until you get a real feel for the game.
Okay. It's not the type of game, as you well know, Ronan, that I would immediately be drawn to.
Nor me, Sean, to be honest.
But I suppose if I'm going to pick positives up, it looks like it's a nice tactile game. Those pieces look nice and the clink as they stack together, and they kind of nice feel to the game. I'm struggling. I'm clutching at straws here.
Yeah, I got it in early learning centre. There's a thing you can press that goes. It actually has got the physical pieces are so simple And the fact that height is so important, it is so clear. And actually, like you were saying about clinking and all that, the tactile aspect of it is actually quite important, because you click them across and you go, boom, that's now a four height tower. That now moves four spaces. And the fact that you can see so clearly, and I can look across any space and go, okay, that tower is three tall. That means it can only go into possibly those six spaces. Much more likely not six spaces, because if it's near the edge of the board, it can't go that way. If one of those spaces three away is empty, it can't go into them. It works that it is so physical, and yet that represents in-game mechanics. The fact that once a space is empty, it's dead. It will never have a piece in it again. It shows up. I can see how things are going to get isolated, because once you've broken down the chain, there's no way to get the chain back again. That works as well. And the fact that when towers become very tall, you know, if I stick a four tower on top of a four tower, it becomes an eight tower. It's very unlikely to be able to move, but it's still open to attack from smaller towers that are around it, so it can build up and get higher and higher, but it's not going to go anywhere. And that is also very physical. So those physical aspects that you talk about are actually quite important to gameplay, and quite important to be able to see and learn some of the strategies as to what's going on.
All right, well, go on. Is it any good, Ronan? Because I have no idea.
It's the classic thing, mate. It's easy to play, difficult to master. When you start off, there's loads of move available. And you look at it and you go, oh man, I can move anything anywhere here. I have no idea what difference any of these is going to make. And you kind of have to throw yourself into it and go, right, I'm just going to take some moves and see what happens. I think it's definitely one of those games. Same with so many two-player abstracts. Don't learn it with someone who knows how to play it, because that's too hard and you're going to get smooshed and they're probably going to be bored. Try and find someone, get it out, read the rules, listen to what I just said. Those are literally the rules, and play it together. And that process of discovery is loads and loads of fun. Generally, kind of, if you're looking at an area board and you're making up some plans, you're thinking, how is my opponent going to counter me? And within two or three games, you can see there are counters, and they go, if I do that, they're going to set that up. If I move that big stack there, they're going to jump on with that one. You think the possibilities, and then it's got the lovely thing of suddenly they move somewhere unexpected on the board, and you go, oh, and that whole chain of moves you were kind of thinking about, or possible moves, you now jump across and start focusing on another area of the board and go, hold on, do I finish off doing what I'm doing here? Or do I allow them the chance to chain moves together on that part? Because if the person doesn't mess with you, suddenly you can start building up and going, great, I can now do the next thing, I can do the next thing. So you kind of have to follow each other around the board. So it's quite confrontational, but obviously in this abstract, weird way. I've had loads of fun learning it. I really want to delve deep into it, carry on playing it. It's making me wonder about the rest of these Gipf Project games that are coming out. But it's actually making me go, I'm not buying them, because that'll take my focus away from playing D.Va.N. another few dozen times and discovering it and digging in and pulling out what's there and beginning to feel competent in this game. So look, if you're a fan of two-player abstracts, if you haven't played D.Va.N., by all means, give it a go. If you're not a fan, it is very easy to get into. It's getting reprinted. I would say just give it a go. Get past that first thing of what is this? And you will find the cogs in your mind triggering, whirling, turning, and fun will start to kick in.
Okay. All right, so I've been quite a miserable cuss so far this episode, and spoiler alert, it's not going to change.
Don't spoil it! It could be amazing! You like the networks?
Yeah, I did, actually.
Okay. It was
good to go. Anyway, next up is Sapiens from Yellow.
Hold on, is it any good?
I'm not giving that away, you told me not to.
Okay, fair enough.
2 to 4 players, designed by Cyril Leroy, or Leroy, if you're going to go that way. And what is it? It is a game set in the prehistoric era, where your clan leaders leading your clan to a better habitat. It is a tile laying and route building game, where each tile has 2 special powers and must be laid next to any matching power on a board with a grid on it. And the tiles are very domino style, with different powers on either end. Once you have 2 matching power types next to each other, they are going to give that player a specific power. Now, the powers range from, you can lay additional tiles, you can earn additional points, you can get mammoth stakes, which are things that you can trade various amounts for points.
Mammoth stakes.
I thought that might impress you. Or you can place a bear token, another thing that Ronan likes, good bear.
I like a bear.
You do like a bear on another player's board, and that messes them up. Another thing Ronan likes to do in games. So there you go. So it sounds like it's your game. Mammoth stakes, bears, and messing people up. And all the tokens you get are from a common pool. There are also point areas on the board edge, and when they are covered by tiles, they will score you points. The tiles are laid consecutively to the edge of the board. And that's pretty much Sapiens. Ronan, did you have a look at this rule book?
No, I didn't read the rule book, Sean.
Don't read the rule book.
Okay, don't read the rule book. Good.
Don't read the rule book.
Let me write that down. Good, yeah.
The rule book is got missing words, it's got ambiguous rules, it's got a horrible layout, it is awful. It tells you you've got a personal supply of bears. Oh, there you go. And you don't. At no point
no
does it say.
About that.
At no point does it say any rule about how you get this personal supply of bears. That's just one of the things. It was awful. We've had many a good game that starts off with an awful rule book, Ronan.
Not in this case, apparently. I don't know. I don't know what possessed you to get this game. It was big at Spiel 2015. There's banners everywhere. It was in that hall with someone has drawn all the rest of it. Unusually for me, for a yellow game, it doesn't even look attractive, Sean.
I actually think it actually looks quite nice. I think the colours are bright and bold and vivid, and the cartoony look to the game is fine.
We can't agree on artwork recently. One of us has to go to Specsavers.
Probably a bit of column A, column B.
Like, yellow usually find an interesting way to present, and this one just looked generic to me. Okay, anyway. The dual scoring, where you score the lowest of your two scores between shelter and food each game. Does that add any tension and excitement to it?
Not really.
Right,
so hard. It's so hard to get to the edge of the board because it's
the shelter things, right?
Yeah, to the shelter things. It's so hard to get to the edge of the board that it's actually, that's where the tension is. Can you actually get the right tiles from the very few available to you to actually get to the edge of the board, and you don't have a lot of space to work in? As I said, they're domino tiles, so if you match one end, you've got to make sure that the other end isn't touching something that it doesn't match with. And as the space runs out, you realise that choices you make very early in the game can really hamper you going forward.
One of the other criticisms I've heard about it is that you can try and do that and you can plan perfectly, but there's a restricted parade of tiles you can choose from, and sometimes they just don't come up. So the game's trying to reward you for clever play and clever planning, and sometimes, again, back to luck of the draw, it just screws you over.
Exactly that. Exactly that. It is.
Oh, I did my homework.
Well done. Sometimes you're just sitting there and you've got, maybe in the very first draw, there's a couple of things that there's maybe one or two copies of, and you think, right, okay, that's the path I'm going down. That might not turn up again for another four rounds. And by that stage, you've completely reached a dead end because you have to match that tile.
Both ends. It's funny. And all around. So you have to try and create these blocks of certain terrain. And just,
yeah.
And there's no two-ended ones that are the same, so you can kind of...
Exactly, yeah. And
doesn't look good for me, mate. Yeah. There's reasons I didn't go near it last year.
You're kind of hemmed in. Once you've decided on the two or three icons, looking for those all the time, and you're getting the same reward over and over again, so you're not really branching out and you've not got any variety. And there is obviously the opportunity for you to sneak out a little bit and try something different. But also, the iconography, they're tiny. The little icons on each of those tiles is tiny. And so one of the things you can do is steal a tile from another player, and it's just a case of you have to almost get up, walk around the table. We had the same problem with Imperial Settlers, where you just don't really know what anybody else has got because it's impossible to read from across the table. And it's just terrible. And it just becomes multiplayer solitaire until you randomly get that power, and then you're walking around the table to see what everyone else has got.
Yeah, it's another common criticism that the player attacks don't really work. The other one thing I'll say, before you sum up, I thought it always looked too stressful to be fun. When I looked at it last year, I haven't heard good reports of it, so it never really rang my bell at all. But the last possible nail in the coffin for me is that it's possible for a player to play, run out of places where they can place one of the tiles down, and it's not that hard to do, and then they're just out of the game until everyone else finishes. I'm pulling a face, Sean. I'm pulling a face.
If one of your routes just reaches a dead end and you can't get that tile or those tiles to match to get into your onto your tableau to place, then you can start again in a completely new area, but all of that land becomes dead area and you can't interact with it at all. You can't lay over it. So, yeah, you run out of space really quickly. So if that was a quite extensive route and it snaked across your nearly your whole board, even starting again on the far side isn't going to give you that much area to work with. It's going to make it very hard, and eventually those two areas are going to collide and you are going to run out of space. So yeah, that is absolutely possible.
You haven't sold it to me. Final thoughts of Sapiens.
I was trying to just not doing my job, am I? A route building game. I've been trying to play a lot more of them recently because I keep whinging about they're not my thing and not very good at them, so I thought, you know what, let's play some more of them. This one I had actually quite high hopes for. But I thought it looked decent, I thought it looked hard, and I thought it would test us. It doesn't so much test us as it just batters you over the head with, like, you just can't do things sometimes. The player interaction is awful. You only really interact with each other negatively and to do something that doesn't really work. It's multiplayer solitaire, and not for me. I'm going to pass on Sapiens.
It has been a tough episode from you.
It has. I've been a miserable so-and-so.
Do you need a hug?
I know. Yeah, I think I do.
And do you know what? I don't know exactly what you think of Mansions of Madness, but we're all going to find out because that's our big review coming up next.
Okay, we are now going to go into main review territory, and it's one of the big beasts of the moment, Ronan. It's Mansions of Madness, the second edition. Following on from the first edition designed by Cory Konieczka, we now have a second edition that comes with a brand spankly new app, which is Fantasy Flight's new big thing at the moment, designed by Nikki Valens, and plays 1 to 5 players in a whole range of time frames, depending on the mission. It's the latest in the Arkham Files range. The game centres around 4 scenarios in the form of mysteries that players will try to solve after entering without knowing how to do this or even the exact nature of the mystery. Each player is an investigator with a unique backstory and a unique power. Basically, you're going to be exploring a mansion or a building by revealing one room at a time, depicted by laying room tiles down. Each room will have interaction points in the form of things to look at or investigate. It will have non-player characters to interact with and have a chat to. You have puzzles to solve and doors to open, and of course you're going to have enemies to fight. You also have items lying around and you can pick them up, add them to your inventory or use them. The app is going to set up each room for you. It will describe the contents, bring monsters in, and guide players in their search for answers. Players will do their own upkeep though, and will gain both psychological and physical injuries along the way. And should they amass too many, they're going to die or go insane. The app, as in Descent, is going to increase the difficulty if you take too long, and will tell players should they succeed in solving the mystery, or in some cases, if they have failed. That, in a nutshell, is Mansions of Madness. So we're going to start where we always start. How does this bad boy look?
Fabulous.
Fabulous, darling.
That's what I'm putting out there. A couple of niggles, which we'll get to, but mostly tiles look amazing. Best game tiles I think I've ever seen. Artwork's great. Cards and all the rest of it. It's FFG. The presentation with the app itself all looks absolutely wonderful. It all works. Yes, yes, yes. I'm going to guess we've got agreement on that.
We have with the tiles for sure. They are ridiculously detailed. I love the cards in Fantasy Flight, especially the Arkham Files range of games. You almost know what they do before you read the text, and I find that it kind of lends to the game itself. So if you're picking up doing a spell where you're shriveling someone, for instance, you see somebody casting a spell and you see some shriveled creature in the background. Now, I do have an issue, though.
I've got two, so there you go.
Oh, it's a component issue, Ronan.
It's the minis, isn't it?
It's the minis.
I knew it. Go on.
Well, we're going to come at it from two angles, right?
Much like they do towards standing up. You're right, mate. You're looking a bit wonky.
Just a bit. So, the plastic that Fantasy Flight use for all of their miniatures, it does bend out of shape. You do spend a lot of time, if you're a bit finicky like I am, trying to put things back into shape. Now, normally, they're on their own little bases, and it's all pre-packaged with the base, so it's not too bad. It just becomes a finicky problem. On this, it actually becomes an actual problem of getting them to go on the bases, because they don't fit the bases very well. If they're out of shape at all, they tend to flop over in the box. Unless you have glued those things, they will come apart, and setup time then becomes an absolute pain in the bottom.
I like the jaunty hybrid. You put him in one way, he's wonking that way. Put him in another way, he's wonking. He's having a little dance as you move him along. I don't even think the minis look very good.
They're not the best. They're not the best. They're not the most detailed. I think the star spawns look pretty impressive.
Yeah, a couple of them. But overall, yeah. Also, they seem to have unnecessarily massive bases.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they do take up a lot of that beautiful artwork on the tiles. And also, Ren, a small quip. You've got tiles that you slide into the base of the creatures.
That's easy to do.
That's easy to do if you've got a pliers and a hammer and a God knows what else handy.
Team of oxen.
Yeah, team of oxen to drag.
Is this whole thing just a hangover from first edition or something? It just seems such a clunky way of doing things. You're sliding them in just to be able to see two numbers. What?
But you need to be able to see the special abilities of the creature, which I understand. But the front of the tile is beautiful. And you're never going to see that again. Believe me, even if you want to see it again, unless you crack the base open, you're never seeing that again because they are stuck.
I guess it's from first edition. I never played first edition, but all right. My other small gripe is, and it's not exactly to do with how it looks, but the tiles are fantastic. In a reasonably length game, so I'm not talking about what the massive fourth scenario, you don't see many of them. You don't get a chance to see this mansion unfold. It's quite limited on the table.
I kind of like that, though. I think it adds to the mystery element of it. Yeah, you don't see all the...
It is a bit more like Huts of Madness.
I don't know. In the first mission, when you play it, and if you're not particularly slick, as we tend to be, and getting from A to B and solving the mystery, you do tend to get quite a sprawling mansion appearing. The second mission's even less so. The second mission's just a hotel, and it's the one floor of a hotel. So
maybe I'm expecting something more epic, but it's just a bit tight and confined to me. But anyway, never mind. As well as looking good, Sean. Do they do their job, the components? Do their job with setup, as you were talking about with the monsters, about sticking them in and that? How does it work functionally as a game?
Just in terms of components, I think, apart from obviously the monster issues, I think it works perfectly well functionally. You can knock the rooms about, but everything is obvious where it slots into. The investigators stand out from the monsters, the card. They're all fine. You've got those little tiny usual Fantasy Flight stock that are designed so they're not to take up too much of your table space. But I think from a functional point, it doesn't raise any major issues for me.
Yeah, I think it's clean. I think it's lucky that the app holds lots of the information. So rather than having lots of cards with loads of rules written on them, they're able to be quite streamlined in what they've got because the app's going to do a lot of the work for you. And I'm sure we're going to get on to that.
Yeah, I think once you have glued those monsters into space, then the setup is actually quite quick for a Fantasy Flight game.
Yeah, very quick, because the app you just run straight into it. In terms of components anyway, the app just tells you what to do.
But Ronan,
yes,
this is at a Recommended retail price in this country, £92, is a very expensive game. And it was one of the reasons I didn't buy it first off.
No. Just no. I don't know. I can't see the reason why it would be that expensive. There's not enough content in the box. It's overpriced by at least 50%. I think £60 would be expensive for this game. I don't understand why it's so expensive. And you know what? There's no way I'm buying it at that price.
Yeah, I had to wait for it to come right down in price. I think I got it on a special offer somewhere else where I traded in stuff to get more of a percentage off. Other than that, I wasn't going to buy it. It just, there's not that much in the box.
There's really not.
What are you actually getting? No.
It's crazy. £13 more than Rebellion, which was overpriced.
And there was a hell of a lot more.
I don't know where that price comes from. I think it's ridiculous. I think the pricing has gone crazy in board games. But anyway, we're going to move on. Sean, the very heart of it. How well does that uprun the game? It's absolutely integral to the play experience. There's no way it's optional. There's a way you could do it any other way. You have to go via the app. How does it do that job?
Well, I am actually a big fan of the app in Mansions of Madness. I think in many, many ways, it's the star of the show. I think it sets the scene brilliantly. I think it has thematic intros. The voiceovers are very well done, as you would expect from Fantasy Flight. I think it changes things up, different player counts. Also, it changes the way you fight the monsters as well. It's not always your strength against their whatever. It changes agility and intelligence, and even observation comes into some of the battles. So, and the text is always different. There's different things happening all the time. So I actually think it's fantastic, Ronan.
It does everything. That is both its strength and its weakness. It does do all those things. It does mix it up. It does change things around. But then I don't make any decisions. The app is playing the game and I'm kind of inputting every now and then. So I got a couple of things to go over this. You talked about combat. When you choose to fight a monster, you click on the monster draw. You say that monster, you say I attack it. And you say how you attack it, whether you're unarmed, a bladed weapon, shooty or a bludgeoning weapon, whatever it might be. A shooty is a technical term. Don't use that. I don't even know how that weapon's going to work. So we had a situation, one of our games, where we had a knife and an axe, where the stronger character had the knife and the quicker character had the axe. And we thought we'd swap over because knife, agility, axe, strength, maybe. And then the knife would come up as strength and the axe would come up as agility and they'd swap around. And you'd be like, I can't make any decisions about how to fight here. You know, or a punch is as good as a knife. What?
Yeah, I don't get the unarmed combat being quite powerful at times and it can do lots of damage. But I have kind of bought into how the scenarios would play out. So I've kind of bought into the different ways of attacking. So different things will happen. Monsters won't always attack you in the same way. So if you're in the room, sometimes you're going to be off balance or they're going to get the jump on you. And
that's cool. Give me the choice. Do you choose to stand firm? Do you choose to move around it? You read out a paragraph saying, you see the monster come towards you. You decide to dart round behind it, bounce off the wall, and attack it from behind, roll for agility. I didn't decide that. You decided that. Give me the choice. Let me decide. Do you wish to stand firm? Do you wish to use observation and see if you can make it slip over? Do you wish to use your agility and bounce the ball off the wall and slap it on the back of the wing or whatever it might be? It's doing it, Sean.
Yeah, you're right. I think that would have been a better way of doing it. Give you maybe two options. Do you want to A, use your strength to try and overpower the creature, or B, use your observation to see if there's anything in the room that you could possibly use to attack the creature?
A bit of fight and fantasy. Go to page 67, go to page 69. This is what I'm talking about. So
exactly.
What it does, with the app being so all-consuming, and it does do things positively, and we'll get to some more positive things, I don't feel like I'm playing a game. I feel like I'm in an interactive movie. And if I'm playing with, let's say, four players, every 15 to 20 minutes, I'm doing two actions. And then I'm watching everything else happen. Then I'm watching the app make all these decisions for me, how things go, what dice I roll, which one of my attributes I'm going to use for each test. I go, okay, cool, okay. Oh, I roll dice. Okay, what happens now? I put in two. What happens? You tell me what happens. It's entertaining, and I don't want to give an impression that I'm not enjoying myself, but it's more like a film than a game.
I didn't want to go that far. Yes,
the app. I might be pushing the point a little bit.
Yes, the app does do certain things for you. It takes a lot of that upkeep away from you. I just enjoy the experience of the app telling me what to do, and you don't have to have someone constantly referring to things and hang on, what do you do when this monster happens, or what do you do when this thing happens? You just click on it, it's there. Happy days. I think what that might irritate you slightly, I enjoy it. I enjoy being part of this experience and part of this movie, if you like.
See, I did say I enjoy it.
Yeah, but it doesn't irk me at all. It doesn't bother me. I think I've got my decisions to make elsewhere.
It bothers me at the time, but I don't feel like I've played a game. I feel like it's this thing of turn on the TV, turn your brain off, some things happen to you. Okay, cool. You know, like the app creates a great atmosphere. It really does. It's got the ambient noises, woman screaming, scare the bejesus out of us. It gives you great character to what you're doing. It drives on the story. You do feel like investigators going in, trying to discover what's going on. But it does too much. But anyway. Let's move on. We're getting bogged down on it. How do you prefer the app be used? Everyone clicking it, one person sort of being that dungeon master and playing it out. How do you think the best way to interact with the table is with this app? Because you have to work out the best way somehow.
I have worked out my favourite way to use the app. Anything less than this now leaves me a bit disappointed. I like hooking it up to a big screen in a slightly darkened room so that everybody can see what's happening with the app, see what's appearing on the room, so you don't have to constantly say, right, hey, a question mark goes there, a exploration marker goes there, and a block goes there, and block off that door. None of that you have to do. Everyone can then see, okay, so you're in charge of doors, you're in charge of exploration, you're in charge of non-player characters. Boom, everyone just gets on with their business. They can see exactly what's happening. You've also got the music in the background setting the scene for each of the scenarios. Also, I like to have one narrator, one person who is good at reading, can deliver it thematically. You did it in the game we played at your house, and I felt that that worked.
You just like me reading stories to you, whatever the situation is.
I do.
Maybe a little stroke of the brow just to ease your worries. Yeah, that sticking it through the TV is fantastic. It's brilliant. It does that. Just amazingly, you're right, everyone's engaged. It's not one person scrying over an iPad going, oh, okay, we need to do this, we need to do that. Everyone is really part of it. Perfectly happy with that. The whole narrator thing, I don't really mind. I think it's just that the kids started getting tired and they didn't want to read anymore. So, okay, someone has to read it. You're a beautiful reader too. Let's not take that away from you.
Thank you.
You're right.
Okay, so we've talked about setting up the app and setting up the ambience. How well do you think that the theme of this whole game is conveyed, both apps, components, etc.?
Do you want the good or the bad first?
Go on, hit me with the bad.
I'll go with good, you're right, okay. Total immersion in it. Fully in the story. You're in there. You feel like investigators turning up. You've got a little bit of information. What's going on? Okay, that sounds spooky. Let's hit this. And you're there and you don't know what's coming around the corner and you don't know what's going to happen and you're talking in-game characters. You are Minty Fanshawn. I am Father Mateo. Rachel's the urchin. Whatever it might be, it so works for creating that story.
It is. You can see this mansion taking shape. You are genuinely exploring. It's not just a board where you know what's coming up next. I do feel like I'm part of an unfolding mystery. And that's an important element as well. You don't know what you're investigating. Every room can be that final room and that final challenge, but you don't know. And I love that part of it. It is a mystery.
It is a mystery and there's flavour and you've got that sense of discovery and what are we going to find? What do we need to do? That is great. However, the story is set on rails and it's going to happen. And I'm a passenger in that story. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I might look at that painting or I might not. the story's going to happen anyway.
Yes, it is. But again, it's very hard to convey a story like this without putting it on rails to a certain degree. Let's go back to your earlier comparison, the fighting fantasy books. They're on rails. You're either going to die or you're going to get to a certain ending.
Firstly, we should have moved on in 35 years. Secondly, the app is capable of much, much, much more. And thirdly, at least there were different routes to get in there. And I made genuine decisions. And what I decided to do affected what I had and what experience I've been through. In this, it's a small map. There's only a certain amount of things to find and things are going to happen at certain rounds. That's it. Apart from the massive fourth scenario, but it's a slightly bigger map, but still the same general principle.
It is, and it's going to be literally a case of, if you don't mind that, then this is probably the product for you. I don't think it makes any promises to be anything else, to be fair to it.
Okay. There's a lot of theme. We got that bit. We've spoken a lot about Fantasy Flight games this year. We've spoken a lot about barrier to entry and rules. For you, the ease of learning and the game flow, how did it all go?
I think it's an absolute breeze. The rules are actually clear. The appendices is actually helpful. The app, as we've said, takes a lot of the strain, telling you how to set up, allowing you to go back and look at things, explaining what you're testing yourself against. So the app kind of takes a lot of that, as Steve would say, Fantasy Flight fatigue away from you.
Every episode we've got to mention it, haven't we?
It's every episode.
Contracted now. You know, if one person knows how to play, I don't think you need a rules explanation. I think you fire up the app, you put down the first tile, here's a room. Then they go, what's that? Click on that. It's a painting. You may go and look at it if you want to. What's that? That's a drawer. You can look in there if you want to. What are these? It's a door. Go and click on the thing. You can hear something behind it. Open that if you want to. You get two actions you can do. Go. I think you could play like that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we pretty much did that with your daughters. And we just said, like, we're going to start.
It's almost automatic. You go, this is where you are. You're in this room. What do you want to do? Like an RPG. It's like, what do you want to do? Your choice. Yes, it's restricted. There's interaction points and certain things they can do. But it works in a similar way.
But I think, Fantasy Flight may have found the answer to all of those rules and exceptions to rules and exceptions to rules and all of that nonsense that they used to cram into those rule books. It's all in the app now, and if the app's handled well, for games with the app, obviously
it's okay in a lighter mechanical game like this, but in lots of games you need to know what the rules are in order to make decisions. You know, they had the app for XCOM. You couldn't play it until you'd played it. Because you're trying to make decisions with no idea of what the consequences were. So I think you have to be careful saying this could be the answer. I don't think it is, but I think it works here. In terms of game flow, I'm slightly harping back to my previous thing. I think it's terrible. Because in a four-player game, I might be doing something for 5 minutes every hour. Because our phase is a couple of minutes long each. And then that includes clicking on something and reading on the app. And then the app takes over and runs itself for 10 minutes. Roll this, do that. Monster does that, roll this. This hits you, you have a nightmare. Okay, back to two actions each. And I just find it stutters the game.
I don't think it's as cut and dry as that. I think you also have the interaction between the players talking about what the best thing is to do for each player, what order you're going to move in, where you're going to go, what's the best monster to fight first, whether to use a spell. I think there's a lot more to it than I take my two actions and I sit for 55 minutes doing nothing.
In fairness, I said I did 5 minutes active and 55 minutes inactive.
Okay. I think that's very harsh. I think you're constantly involved in the game. You're constantly involved in the group choices. You're immersed in
everything that's happening. You're not. Someone says,
I am.
I'm in this hallway. I'm going to go look at that painting. You go, cool. They go look at the painting. They click on the app. They roll some dice. The app tells them something. Okay, cool. Next person. I'm going to go look in this drawer. Cool. They roll some dice. Oh, the app tells them that. Okay, cool. I walk in this room. Cool. The app tells them something. Okay, cool. Then the app does a load of stuff for 10 minutes. You roll these dice. Okay, horrific. You roll these dice. Okay, cool.
No, you're making it sound like a terrible experience.
I'm not doing anything. I'm not making any decisions. I'm just sitting there. You roll those dice. I got two successes.
We had many, even in the game at your house, we had many discussions about what monsters to tackle, who needs protection, who needs things passed on to them, what's the best equipment to be picking up, where the next monster is likely to come from, do we barricade things, do we leave things open, is fire going to break out, there's shadow in that room. There's lots of things we're discussing. It's not just, you make it sound such a dull experience.
I didn't say it was dull, I've said all
but
the
you're making
the
it sound like
great
that.
Because I'm not doing anything.
You're taking part in the whole gaming experience is what you're doing.
Okay.
I do agree that these apps, they're always going to have that problem where you are spending a lot of time clicking through screens and reading the screens. And I think with the higher player counts, it's actually slightly better because there's more time in between you go to the app and interact with the app, and you do have a bit more discussion around the table. With a two-player game, which is fine, I enjoy a two-player game, it is like that. You're just both doing your actions. There's not a lot of discussion because there's only two of you, and then you're going back to the app and you're constantly back and forth to the app. I think there's a little bit of padding between app interaction with the higher player counts.
Well, go on then. We're talking about player counts and lower player counts. And I might agree with you there that at least the higher player counts, you have more options and there is more discussion of we can do more things on a turn than just being stuck in one area. But is there an ideal player count? And how's the difficulty of the game? Does that relate in any way to player count?
As I said at the top, I like the way that the game adapts to different player counts. I haven't noticed that the game is any easier or more difficult. I've won and lost with low and high player counts. I've just said everything about it being a lot more interaction with the players and a lot more chat around the table. But the payoff for that is obviously going to be a longer game. And this game can go very long. In the first scenario, it's actually supposed to be one of the shorter ones. And with the five of us, that went very long.
3.5 hours.
Yeah, so it's a very long game. But you can save it and come back to it. So you have got that. But not ideal if you want to just bosh out a quick game.
I will say that overall it's a tough game. And that is good. I'm not sure it scales that well. Only in that the monsters are part of the main threat. And the more of you there are, the much easier it is to deal with monsters. And when one monster spawns, you don't have to concentrate all your resources on dealing with one monster. And if someone misses, it's not catastrophic because someone else might be able to back them up. Slight feeling for combat there, that with more players, it balances out a bit more. But the good news is that the monsters are genuinely scary. And when you go to deal with them, you're like, whoa, I'm going to take a bit of a whack in here. And it's well possible I could get damage. Now, damage is a very interesting system, in fact. And you can get mental or physical damage. Sometimes you get them face down, which means it's just a point against like normal Arkham file screen. I've got 7 health. If I take 7 health damage face down, I'm dead. Fine. Sometimes you have to flip them over and they all have individual problems with them. And that brings some flavor into the game. Now, I've got mixed feelings on it. I kind of love it. But there's certain situations where it kind of feels a bit wonky. Sean, damage.
I'm all about the flavour. I love the damage in this. I love that you're not sure what's going to happen. Now, yeah, it can completely almost ruin the game for you. I mean,
for an individual player.
Yeah, for an individual player, it can almost sort of rule them out of doing anything of note in the game. Like, we had the situation that we managed to counter, because there are counters to everything.
And there needs to be. There needs to be this mitigation.
Yeah, well, your daughter...
I know what you're going to talk about. She was the athlete.
She was the athlete. She was our runner. She was our strong character. She was supposed to be going in doing all the fighting.
She can move 3 spaces at once when usually
you
can move 2.
Moving
so
quickly out of danger. Yeah. We had big plans. And her first injury... She broke her leg. Now, normally we'd be absolutely rolling around if it was one of us. Because it's a 10-year-old, it kind of felt sad, and she had her pouty face on, and it wasn't
She was
wasn't
a little
nice.
Bit upset, because that was her superpower. That was what makes you special. You're so fast, you can dart in and dart out. Oh, your leg's broken.
Your leg's broken now, but luckily we were able to heal her, and her leg unbroken, and recast or reset, and she was able to continue as the plan we had set out for her.
But they do add a lot of flavour, but they're very situational, and they can be.
It's
a long game to drag
it.
A broken.
It is a long game,
or
and
to
I
be
understand.
Scared of doors or whatever.
I understand completely where you're coming from. I mean, this happened to me where we had that impassable loop in our very first game of this
with
when
the
we
fire.
Were stuck. We were stuck in fire. We were stuck with two creatures. To do anything, you had to evade the creature.
To try and put out the fire.
Yeah,
which wasn't
I had two mental blocks where it completely affect my ability to evade. So every time I tried to evade, I had like maybe one die. And I was constantly failing. The fire was burning me. Fail, burn, smashed by the creature. Done. We were gone. We were out of there, buddy.
Yeah, it's a long old game for that sort of thing, you know.
I see where you're coming from. I get it, but I love it.
It does mean
I love it.
Every single blow counts. You are in genuine peril. Brings me back to the monsters feel difficult and scary, and it does fit in that you are just random people, almost from the street, who have been brought together by something to go into this perilous situation. Thematically, it's brilliant.
And that's where I live. That's
yeah,
my wheelhouse.
That's where you live. But when educated,
I get what
become,
you're saying. I get
you know,
what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay. As well as the damage, Sean, puzzles.
Oh, I love a puzzle.
Do you?
I love a puzzle. It just reminds me of some of those sort of next generation Xbox games that we used to play that you could go into an arcade and play a retro game, like a little sub game within the game. And I like to play them thematically, so explain puzzles a little bit better. You will enter a space, it will say to unlock this or to go further, you must do this puzzle. And it can be a symbol puzzle where you have to get the right sequence of symbols or numbers, or just moving things into a certain place, so moving pictures around so the picture matches what it's supposed to look like. How many moves you've got each time you interact with this puzzle is based on your lore or your willpower. And obviously multiple people can come in and do it. So the way I like to do it is if you're not in the room, you can't interact with the puzzle because you're not there. We're doing it thematically. If you want to come in and solve the puzzle, then you must come into the room and do the puzzle. And at one stage at Ronan's house, we had all five people, all with five different opinions on how to solve this puzzle. And it was a genuine, yeah, we've done this. We've succeeded. So little mini game within the greater confines of the game that I really enjoy.
I think it's a fantastic idea. I don't think it's been 100% done correctly. Some of them are fantastically easy. That might be a time when the iPad actually helps, because you could hand the iPad over to the person and say, there's your puzzle, rather than having this group think. Because the group think was cool because, you know, we're used to playing with the family and we're all being open and giving each other a voice and letting each other talk. But you can see it getting taken over by one person, couldn't you?
Yeah, you can. But as you always say, Ronan, that's the problem with the person, not the game.
Oh. Nice. Right. You're pretty happy with Mansions of Madness, Sean. Could you improve it? Sean Rice, game designer.
Right, moving forward. So the obvious ones are to streamline the app, and we've already talked about add a bit more variety to each mystery. So give some options to the fights, a little bit of a different setup, and maybe even throw in an alternate ending to each of the mysteries. A bit of miniatures, obvious again. I think the biggest thing that I would love to see for this, Ian, I'm heralding back to my Hero Quest days, Ronan.
As you always do.
As I always do. It was my favourite thing. I can't remember if it was your favourite thing. What was your favourite thing about Hero Quest?
Trying to beat you.
Mine was was designing
designing your
quests.
Own adventures. Yeah.
Design. If you had a
there's
creator,
a few pads of graph paper wasted back in the day.
There was indeed. If you could design your own scenario and using the tiles, put them together in a big mansion and just post it online, and with some, make your own flavor text up and your own ways to battle the creatures and what creatures appear, I don't think it would be a massively hard thing for them to do, and I would absolutely lap it up.
Interesting. Player generated content. Nice. City Heroes did that, you know. It was amazing. Okay.
There you go.
It's my annual City Heroes reference. Splitting the party when you have more members, so that you come in two different doors or you're trying two different things and you've got to get together and match up. I would like that, because certain spaces can feel redundant and you can feel like sometimes you're spending your whole turn, which is your only turn for 20 minutes, to walk through four spaces just to catch up with where the rest of the party is. So maybe having two halves when you get to five or six players and onwards. And the other thing is, I just think it's too small and I want there to be more rooms and more to do rather than very slowly going through four or five rooms. Having one knife for six adventurers to share feels a bit silly. So you need to have more content when there's more people there. I also don't understand how we do defeat a giant snake monster by punching it as hard as we can. With all the best will in the world, I don't think that's going to work.
One thing also, Ronan, just to go back a little bit into the episode, it's something that kind of dawned on me. I don't think it's for children, this app. Not for young children, certainly. It's very descriptive. Some of the effects in it are really gruesome, things slitting their throats and things bubbling out of their throats, and I think it is quite horrific sometimes, so I think there is definitely something to bear in mind if when playing with children.
You call me a bad parent for letting my 10-year-old play it.
I think your children were just about of an age, but if you're playing this with a 6, 7, 8, and 8-year-old, I think
a horror game, you got to think that.
You got to think about, but it is very explicit sometimes, some of the things
they
happened.
Did say that. I think they kind of enjoyed it a bit, like, oh, that's a bit gory. fair enough. Usually at this stage, Sean, we talk about expansion. I don't know if you've got anything to say, but it's just too obvious. They've put the bare minimum content in this box again. Harping on, I've said it since Asmodee took over FFG, they seem to be going for bare minimum we can get away with in a box, because we know we're going to expand it a trillion times. There are two expansions out already. I know they use first edition components or something. They're out already. Two.
Yep. And they're making people pay for those first edition components that they may not have had. Yeah, well, we know that's their business model, and as much as it doesn't sit well or leaves a bitter taste in the mouth, you kind of just got to realise that's what they're going to do.
But it's the deliberately it's not putting it in the first box that annoys me.
Yeah, and I agree. I think there is a lot of content in the box in terms of the length of gameplay you're going to get out, but the replay value isn't great.
Okay. You know, when you go to cinema or you're at home and you watch a film with a group, and everyone's enjoying it, and they're all having fun, and you kind of go, maybe the film's not the best, but this experience is good, and I've had a good time, and this has been nice shared time with other people, and we've got something we can talk about. That's what Mansions of Madness Second Edition is to me. If they're happy, if they're having fun, then I'm happy. There's nothing wrong with it. I can't fault the presentation. The theme is there. You're in peril. It does exactly what it tries to do. And I am very happy to play it. I have a good experience. But honestly, I couldn't really care less what my character does. Almost to the point where if someone else chose my two actions every 20 minutes, it wouldn't really change the experience very much for me, because I'm making so few decisions that if you take those two away, it's too fewer decisions every 20 minutes. It makes no difference to me. As Sean will tell you, the most fun I get out of this is role-playing my character. I've decided to be the priest. I'm Father Mateo every time we play it. I do a really bad accent, and I help others play. And I use my accent more often than not just to, go on, you focus, or you do something else. Or some they look like they're getting beaten up. I'm just going to run over there and help them out. The fact that doing that and role-playing the priest is fun tells you how strong this game is within its category. Because I can do it, I can get involved, I can be part of the story, I can find genuine thematic reasons for what I'm doing. But it's not much of a game. There are going to be evenings where I'll say, yeah, Mansions of Madness, fantastic. Let's do that. That will be fun. We'll have a good time. We'll be able to chat about it afterwards. And there will be days when I go, no, sorry, this is a gaming night. I need a game tonight. And that's where I sit on Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition.
You're very harsh. Very harsh indeed, old boy.
Oh, man, I said great and fantastic at least twice. Get out of here.
I think it's more of a game than Ronan does.
Than Ronan is.
Than Ronan is. He's all about the game. And how you play it. There were a couple of things that held me back from this being an insta-buy. And obviously we said about the price, the Descent app, and previous bad experience with the first edition. I didn't talk about that much, but the first edition was somewhat broken. And as we've talked about in previously, but the Descent app, the ramping up of the Doom, it just really irritated me. This is a lot more subtle. The ramping up isn't nearly as in your face. They do get to a point when they just tell you straight up and they're honest. They say, you are taking too long. We're going to start punishing you. But even then, it doesn't become as bad as the Descent app. So that was a step up for me already. Although I still feel that the price is completely insane, this game quickly cast a wither spell on my worries. See what I did there? Nice. The app drives the game brilliantly. And the familiar gameplay provides no barrier to this deeply thematic experience. Some of the usual Fantasy Flight issues are present, but I think their act is cleaned up to such a degree that I've given them a lot. The game is enjoyable, interesting, I think it's a challenge, and satisfying, and to be honest, this is one of my favourite releases of the year. I always have an absolute ball. Yes, it is in my wheelhouse. Yes, it's what I'm all about the theme in games. And I just think this delivers it in spades. And that is Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition.
So, episode 69, bag sealed, delivered, 7 games, in some cases eviscerated by Sean's laser tongue.
Well, it's never been called that before, but...
it has, just never.
And, yeah, we are now going on to a whole slew of Essen games, Ronan. Looking forward to banging our heads off the tables off with badly written rule books and getting very excited.
I'm not sure if it's more exciting thinking about what games we're going to buy or getting the anguished text from Sean. I have his rule book!
Yeah, I don't learn from rule books very well. I usually like play the game through and have that physical element in front of you of the actual game. So just reading the rule books is it's a trial, but it's an enjoyable one.
Maybe you should keep plasticine in front of you while you read them, and you can sort of make the game.
Fashion it. Sometimes it probably turn out better.
Oh, wow. Are we going to have some traps mixed in here, are we?
Possibly. Actually, no. Everything I've seen so far I've been quite positive about.
Yeah, we've got the Essen excitement is going crazy around here. So we will be hoping to fire out some of those previews in the next couple of weeks. Look out for them. If you're going to the show, I am very envious. I can't make it, but we've got a crack team going there. We have got Sean and Natalie descending. We've got interviews lined up already. We've got meetings with publishers. We've got our eye on games. We are going to be getting some live reports from Essen, from Sean and Natalie, getting released on the day. Also, as soon as they're back and our other couriers are back, we are going to be smashing into those Essen games and putting out reports as quickly as we can as to how they actually play rather than our random guesses in the treasure hunts you're going to have to put up with until then.
Brilliant. And as always, we are very proud members of the Dice Tower Network. Go there for some fabulous, as that's the word of the day, fabulous, darling.
Fabulous.
Fabulous podcasts about games. If you wish to download our episodes, please go to Podbean itself. You can also find us on Stitcher and iTunes. If you want to have a little chat with us, you can email us on thegamepitpodcast@gmail.com or pop along to our Board Game Geek Guild. And we are absolutely delighted to have any interaction at all, whether it's telling us we're rubbish or telling us we're fantastic or anything in between, or any questions you've got about the episodes. Please do come along. We are on Twitter at Game Pit Podcast, and you can also find us on Facebook. Thank you very much for listening, and we will hopefully catch you soon for some S and Madness. Music by E. Aaron.